Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. Interest is mounting in Northumberland County as beekeeping season is in early preparations. The Northumberland Junior Beekeepers Program is holding an information session February 4th and 10th for youth aged 9 to 14 to motivate them through education and hands-on experience about the beekeeping industry. Dana Petrillo of Dancing Bee Equipment and John McFarlane of Honeybees Honey & Co. of Millbrook discuss the Junior Beekeeping Program and more about what's involved in honey production.
Beekeeper, basically, that's a good question. It can be many things, but basically what it is we take care of honeybees to make sure that they survive for the year, and then we can either extract their honey or their pollen or any other products of their hive, and just make sure that they survive to live another year.
The word beekeeper is a bit of a misnomer, actually. We don't keep bees. The bees don't care about us. They exist quite happily without us. Everything we do simply duplicates what they do in nature, but just speeds it up. So instead of them having to do everything themselves, we'll provide them with plastic or beeswax frames so they don't have to do it. But it's more for our benefit and also helps them to survive a little bit better. But they don't need us. We don't keep bees. They tolerate us.
So how did the name then, beekeeping, come about? I mean, really, if you're not keeping bees, they're kind of just free to do what they mean. How does that term come about then?
I think it's an older term. When you were keeping things meant you were taking care of. So a beekeeper would be someone who takes care of bees, of their wealth, welfare, their health, everything else. We tend to look at it from a more modern sense and say we keep bees, we do everything for them. They're just our domesticated servants, where in reality, we just assist them doing what they're going to do naturally anyways, and they don't need us, they don't care about us.
Also, in ancient times, we humans would have to hunt the bees, so they would have to track them down and look for them to get their honey. So they didn't actually have any that were always nearby, and often they would have to destroy their nests or their homes in order to extract that honey. So as beekeepers, we also provide them a home that they would choose to stay at, but we don't have to destroy that home or the bees anymore to get their honey. So it comes from being able to keep them in one place, and we don't have to track them down and hunt them anymore.
So when a lot of people imagine what beekeeping is, or the business, you know, you put on the protective gear, you have this, like the smoke cannon or whatnot, and you go to this box in the field, and you kind of smoke out the bees, and then you take out the columns of honey, honeycomb, right?
Yeah.
And then you extract that honey.
Yeah.
In a kind of like a for it's a better term, like a washing machine on the spin cycle, right?
Yeah.
So then the honey drops down, and then what do you do with that honey after it spins down and comes out?
Basically, you're just going to filter some of the wax bits out of it, and then it's ready to consume. So you don't do anything else to it once you extract it. So there's a little bit more to it when you extract it. You have to take the wax off the top, and then it's called an extractor. You spin it, and it's just like a centrifuge. And it comes out, you filter it with just a filter sieve, and to get all the large chunks out, you don't want to do anything else to it. It's perfectly safe, perfectly healthy for you. As is, you do not want to pasteurize it or anything. You want unpasteurized honey.
And honey is just one of many, many things that we can get from a beehive. Honey is not the best income generator either. There's things like a propolis, which is a health medication. There's pollen. There's larvae that can get fried up. There's royal jelly that you can eat. There is wax that you can make candles, lip balms, furniture polish, mustache wax, anything you can think of, candles as well. So there's a lot of different products that can come out of the hive, not just the honey.
As we're expanding into what the business actually entails, most people just believe it's honey is the main contributor out of a hive, and maybe some candles. How do you go about extracting all that for each individual business, what you just described?
So there's different collectors. So for pollen, for example, we call what's a pollen trap. And basically, we just a few days a week for parts of the year, we take the bees come in and they have what they call pollen pants. So the pollen's attached to their legs by hairs, and they go through this contraption that kind of scrapes that pollen off. Basically, you just collect that pollen directly from the pollen trap or from the bee. And then for beeswax, again, when you extract honey, sometimes you're going to take the top off to extract it, so we can use that wax. If there's old comb, you can also crush that old comb up and use it. It doesn't, there's not a lot of wax that comes from each hive. To be fair, if you collect 1 pound of wax from your hive, it takes 10 pounds of honey to produce that wax. So it's a, wax is a highly, it's a very much more energy intensive product for the bee to make. And then propolis is like a bee glue, which is even less than the wax. There's less produced than the wax, and they use it making resin from trees, and they glue everything together. It's extremely hygienic and antibacterial and antiviral for them, keeps the bees healthy. And then royal jelly is also produced by the workers to feed the larva for the first 3 days, and also the queen gets fed the royal jelly for her whole life, which makes her super strong and super big for doing what she needs to do.
At the end of the season, or when the producer is ready to sell his product, is there, where does that product go to get sold? I know that there's some like cash crop farms, but where do you go to sell the pollen? Where do you go to sell the honeycomb? And is that is there an auction site, a central, where does that go?
So most, especially hobbyist beekeepers, will sell it. It's called Farmgate, and they just sell it right off of their property, off their apiary, for many of these products. You can also, we at Dancing Bee, we also purchase a lot of local honey from local beekeepers. We have our own honey that we sell. There's certain regulations if you're going to sell what's called Farmgate, which is off your home, which you can do, pretty much anyone can sell it out of their home. It's like having a fruit stand or a vegetable stand. If you're going to put it into retail stores, you just, you know, you approach those retail stores, and then you, there's just a few more regulations, especially with labeling, that you would need to be able to sell it in retail stores like that. So it's actually not difficult to sell most of these products in Ontario.
So what's the main difference between the honey that I buy in the grocery store and then the honey I might buy from your farm?
So the main difference will be could be location. Much of the honey that you buy in grocery stores is from Ontario, is from local beekeepers, but they're going to be from the larger ones. And you have to watch. So one of the big differences for big, like large honey producers, like Billy Bee or something, is their honey could be pasteurized, which you don't want. It just turns it into basically sugar, or it could be mixed with other honeys or things that are not really honey. So you want to look for 100% pure Canadian honey or 100% pure Ontario honey, and it will say raw, unpasteurized honey, raw honey is what you're looking for.
There's a lot of concern right now in Canada and internationally for what we call adulterated honey, and that's honey that's coming from around the world that may have a lot of sugars, a lot of syrups, a lot of other things added, which makes it not pure honey, makes it adulterated honey, and it's illegal to sell it that way, but it does come in. So the CFIA right now is looking at regulations to be able to test the honey that's coming in that's called honey. So when we sell ours, it's pure unadulterated. It can only be called pure honey if it has nothing added to it. So what you want to look at in a store is you want to look at for pollen granules or for honey that is starting to sort of coagulate or crystallize. That's an indication of pure honey. So a lot of the stores will want something that's uniform in color, that stays runny or liquidy, and that tends to be a pasteurized honey. So it's cooked up over 120 degrees. All the good stuff is baked out of it, but it stays liquid. It looks the same color, and it's not pure honey. So you really, really want to be careful of what the label says.
Now, is there a difference in taste? Do some bees produce different tasting honey than other bees? And if so, what's the difference?
Absolutely. So honey tastes different. You can get honey different from hive to hive, from beekeeper to beekeeper. And the main reason honey tastes different is because of the flowers that the bees are traveling to. So my honey in Cobourg is going to taste way different than John's honey in Millbrook, simply because there's a different variety of flowers. You can, especially if you come into our store, you'll see the varieties of honey. There's like hundreds of different colors. And they will vary. You will even have in the same apiary, bee yard, honey that tastes different from year to year, even though it's the same bee yard, because there's so many. They visit millions and millions of flowers. Depends on the nectar flow. It depends on the weather. It depends on a whole bunch of things. So honey is always going to taste different from region to region, from beekeeper to beekeeper. And it's not a bad thing. It's just that that's just the nature of what honey is. So you can have honeys that you like, and then you can have honeys that you don't like. For example, there's one called basswood that's very popular here. I can't stand it because it's a very minty honey. I don't like it. John loves basswood honey. It's a early spring. It's a spring honey, right? Yeah. So it's a spring honey. And then there's one called buckwheat, which is a later season honey. It's extremely dark, and it's very much like almost like a molasses flavor. And I enjoy the buckwheat, but some people don't. So, and then you get everything in between, depending and what the flowers are that they pollinate.
Okay, so let's talk about the start to the end of the season for bees. How do you get the bees to come back?
So they don't actually ever leave. So we winter them over in their boxes, in their hives. So what we're doing, and beekeeping season is pretty much starting. There's no end, but in January, February, you're planning for your next year. So right now, we're hoping that they make it through the winter, and you're planning for some losses, but you're just saying, okay, they're going to make it through. We've treated for our mites. We've fed them so they have enough food. Hopefully, the spring will come soon enough where they can get out and start pollinating. So we're thinking about all of that now and then replenishing their numbers. So in the height of summer, there's roughly 60 to 80,000 honeybees in one colony. And by entering winter, they start decreasing those numbers down to roughly 15 to 20,000. We hope to come out of winter with around 10,000 or so. And then we're doing everything we can to help them, the queen, start laying her eggs again and replenish those bees. So from our spring here in Ontario, around when the first flowers come out, maybe end of April, early May, we're building those numbers up to make sure they're nice and strong in order to get them to start producing honey. And our height of our nectar flow usually is around, for the first one, end of May, early June is our nectar flow.
So do you store the boxes, the hive boxes, indoors then? Or how does the bee survive the winter? I don't know much about this, so I'm trying to figure out how this survives.
So that's a great question. They actually will form a cluster, and the tighter the cluster, the warmer they can get. So they heat their hive up to about 33 degrees right in the center, because what their goal is to keep their queen warm and the brood, if there's any brood, and as she starts laying. So it has to be kept at 33 degrees. So the very center of your hive with those 10,000 bees will be about 33 degrees, and then as they fall, you reach the outside of the circle, it gets a little cooler to around, 23 or so. And what they do is they vibrate their flight muscles to keep warm, and they'll rotate in and out. So the colder ones will come inside, and then the warmer ones will come outside. So they keep doing that. And they basically do that all winter while feeding on their honey stores. So we want to leave them minimum of 100 pounds of honey that they can access as a cluster, as a group, to feed all winter long. So that's how they, as long as the winter weather stays fairly consistent, it usually is pretty good. The problem comes when the temperatures start reaching above zero, even 0 to 5, 0 to 10 degrees. The bees start breaking a little bit of the cluster. They come out for what we call cleansing flights, because they do not, they don't poop in their hive. So they have to come outside, they do their cleansing flight, they stretch their wings a little bit, and then if it's really warm, they start searching for pollen or nectar. But there isn't any, so we have to make sure that we keep feeding them. And then if it gets cold really quickly after it's a little bit warm, that's where we could get into trouble, because they haven't had time to get back into their cluster. So they stretch their wings, they get they take their cleansing flights, and on these warm days, and then they start coming back to their cluster, especially at night. And as long as they can get back to that cluster in time before it starts getting really cold again, then they can keep each other warm and feed all winter long.
You talked about coming in into the spring, there may be 10,000 bees, mm-hmm. and you're hoping that the queen lays enough eggs.
Yep.
Do you import bees to help the colony succeed, or do you just rely on what the queen can produce?
No, absolutely. So honeybees are not native to North America. So they came over with the colonists on the first ships way back when. So they're not they are climatized to Canadian weather, North American weather, but we do, especially in Canada, rely on a lot of imports, especially early in the season. Our queens, if we raise them here, aren't really ready until June or so, like to like for the first mating and to get our queens out there for other beekeepers. So we start actually importing packages, which is a queen and loose bees, like they're in a tube, usually around the end of March and April. So those come in fairly early, and that's to help replenish, especially commercial beekeepers who pollinate farmers' fields and stuff, so they have to build that up. And then we start importing queens around April as well. So then if we have a queen or a hive that didn't survive the winter, then we can start with our fresh queen, and that, and we can split our other bees, and so it makes it. So we do import queens, and we do import packages as well.
One of the things that is fascinating, that as they're coming out of winter, the queen will start to lay eggs in early spring, and she will lay anywhere from 1,500 to 2,500 eggs a day. And when that happens, that population starts to boom really quickly. So we would, what we call, split a hive. We would take a strong hive and make it two hives, which means one of them either needs a queen now, or we wait for nature to take its course, which could take, you know, a fair amount of time. That's why we bring in imported queens to replace winter losses, but also to populate our new hives as they're developing. Because at 2,500 eggs a day, doesn't take very long for those hives to grow, and we need to do something quickly.
So then how do you control, I mean, you mentioned that, but what happens if you don't have a enough infrastructure to support more hives? Do you just go and get more, or do you create them? What do you do? Do you then cut back on the queen's production? How do you manage that?
So if the queen is laying enough eggs and she's really taking off, the main thing that bees are predisposed to do is swarm. So we want to manage that swarm, and that's like what John said in splitting our colonies. You can split a colony, so then it makes less bees per hive, and add another queen so that they know, oh, we have enough space here, we're going to keep going. So the reason that the bees will swarm is because they're doing so super well. They're like, hey, we've got great genetics, we got a great queen, she's going to lay another queen, and we're going to go and start a home somewhere else because we want to carry on these genetics in another colony. So it's a great, it's beekeepers don't want their bees to swarm, but it's something that we appreciate because, you know, it's a good, it can be a strong colony. So we will buy more equipment, or, you know, build more equipment to just make another colony. So it's a great way for us to increase our colony. So if you had 10 hives going into winter and you had 8 coming out, then those 8 you kind of want, you can split each one of those, so then you can make 8 more hives theoretically from those 8 original hives or more. So that's the role, is you kind of keep going up and down because you're going to lose bees, and then you can create bees as well from those colonies. So
let's talk about the infrastructure then. Obviously you're going to need beehive boxes out in the nature somewhere. You need some clothing, protective clothing. You obviously need the extractor and probably some processing equipment.
Yep.
How much honey is produced per box on average? I mean, I know there's bigger hives, but like on average, what would you say the production
is? Yeah, so on average in Ontario, we have 3 what we call strong nectar flows. So it's usually in early June, late May, early June, and then it'll die off a little bit. And then we have one in July into August, and then we call a dearth, which is where it's really dry and there's not a lot of water or nectar flow. And then towards the end, mid to end of August. So during those 3 for the year, again, depending on the year, we could probably average 60 pounds per colony to up to 100 pounds per colony. So again, it's not a guarantee. Some years are way better than others. Last year was a fairly good year for some of Ontario, but then some of Ontario was experiencing that drought, so it really did hurt the production. So it again, there's a lot to depend on. But in Ontario, we can average it's a fairly short window from June until August, of a honey time, about 60 to 100 pounds. I think that's probably pretty.
In some of my fields, I average about 150 pounds, which is an extremely good year, extremely good flow. But generally, it's around 70, 80 pounds of honey. And that's not including the 100 pounds that I leave for them in the winter. So my harvestable honey, roughly 70 to 80 pounds on a good year, up to 150.
And how many colonies are you guys running each then? Or slash boxes, I guess, hives that people would be able to understand.
personally, in my apiary, I'm only running about 35 hives. We run a few hundred, actually, at Dancing Bee. But those are the ones we use to then split, and we sell it as a commodity. So we sell starter hives.
We also have an education yard at Dancing Bee and an innovation yard as well. And we have about 20 colonies or 25 colonies there as well. So people who want to come take workshops, or we have Me and the Bees tours offered through the Bee Works as well, so that we have those that are accessible for people and you can see. And we have an observation window that's really cool, and some really cool hanging hives, so you can see the comb. So it's almost like they were in a tree in nature, so you get to see all of that as well. So yeah, we run between the two of us a few hundred colonies. So, well, not just the two of us, we actually have quite a few beekeepers at Dancing Bee as well, but John and I are the ones that do, and with Cass, the education and the innovation yard at Dancing Bee Equipment.
Okay, so let's talk about the industry itself, the strength of the industry. Climate change is impacting bees and the production. I used to report on agriculture, so I understood that there was some concern about production of honey. Is there still that concern right now that the production is low, or that the quality of bees or whatnot is not where it should be?
I don't think it's the production of honey per se. Right now, the honeybees are extremely important in agriculture for pollinization. So 80% of agriculture is pollinated with honeybees. So that is where the issue with climate change and honeybee collapse and death come in, is the pollination of the agriculture. The honey production, I think, is fairly steady as we go. I mean, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure the concern is, for the most part, is the pollination of the agriculture. And it's such a huge part, because especially with the way we do agriculture today with the monocultures, we pollinate apple orchards right now. So we take the bees and they go to the apple orchards during the flowering, and then they move back to where our yard. And then we've done blueberry pollination down east, which is a big one. So the pollination, and then everybody knows about the almond pollinating in California, which I think is starting pretty, or it's already begun right now. And millions of colonies come from all over the United States to pollinate the almond fields. So that pollination is a huge reason why the honeybee collapse or die-offs can be very concerning.
Weather is definitely a really important part. If it's too dry, your pollen and source dries up. If it's too wet, it becomes a problem as well. Back east, the blueberry fields had a devastating last 2 years. Drought just wiped out about 80% of the blueberries. I just came back from Nova Scotia, and they said it was devastating for them. So weather definitely will impact what happens with our honeybee and our productions.
With the weather too, the climate change has lengthened our warm weather. So instead of being able to cluster when they're supposed to in, you know, October or so, they're often flying well into November and December. So there's nothing for them to feed on. And then if we get the sudden flash freezes, that's when we have a lot of die-off really early in the winter season too, because the weather has extended, the growing season has extended into December. And then often we can get really wet springs or really cold springs and late springs. So then they're having to last longer without that feed. So the climate change has definitely had an impact all over the world. I know John and I just came from the UAE last year, and they're having issues with extreme heat. So they're feeling the climate change where the bees are not surviving, because it's 45, 50 degrees Celsius, and the bees are not surviving because of that heat. So that isn't for countries like Turkey and Jordan and all those countries over with, and Australia even, it's the extreme heat that they're feeling. So it's definitely having an impact all over the world.
Okay, let's talk about the junior beekeeping program.
Yes.
Why are you trying to get youth involved in beekeeping?
Well, as you can see, especially with John and I, well, John, we're a little older, so beekeeping has been, it's agriculture, and it's hard to get the youth, I guess, in any agriculture. And with beekeeping, we, especially when we go to association meetings or anywhere, it's a lot of the older people that are getting involved. So we need to get youth interested, and teach them that not only honeybees are important, but everything, you know, how get back connected to the to nature. So by having these experiences, because it wasn't always accessible, you know, everybody did commercial beekeeping. And then once we could really get into having it accessible for hobbyists and youth and stuff, because unless you had a family that you were raised that were beekeepers, you wouldn't know anything. So this is really important to get the youth involved to help fill the gap once our older beekeepers, you know, move on. And it's so important to get these kids involved in anything, and they really have a fascination with it, and to dispel the myths of honeybees and say, hey, they're really great, you know, you want to be involved. So
this particular program is unique to North America. It evolved, or as Dana said, my wife and I attending association meetings found that the mean age of a beekeeper was 55 to 60 years old. And when we die, who's taking over? So we were doing a lot of presentations in schools and social groups and churches and clubs and things. We found that the kids were really interested. They knew a lot more than we thought they did, but an hour and a half program just didn't cut it. So we developed this program, what we call the Junior Beekeeper Program. It's a 10-month or a year-long program, and it basically follows the year of a beekeeper. What Dana and I are doing now in our hives is what we will be working with these kids. So it's a combination of training, in-person training, and then in the hive work as well. So what they learn in the classroom, we make them translate into actually working with the hives. And it's been a highly successful program and is gaining traction across the country right now. But that was a desire to motivate young kids to get excited about pollination and the honeybees and the importance of both of those in our society, in our food chain today. And the program has simply developed with that as the core principles, exciting them, getting them motivated, giving them the opportunity to get involved. And we've been finding that kids are coming back year after year. We've sold out. We can only handle so many kids. We've had to terminate some because of capacity. But it's a program devised to educate a new generation of beekeepers.
So then I'm a youth. I'm interested. How do I get involved?
You can go on our website, Junior Beekeepers will find it, juniorbeekeepers.ca. You can go on our websites and look at that, the programs that are offered. Dana runs a program out of Dancing Bee, the Northumberland. I run the program out of Kawartha, out of Millbrook. There are others as well. Newfoundland is just coming on stream. Nova Scotia is interested in doing it. But you can look at that. That's the easiest way to do it. Or contact us directly. We can provide lots of information. But online is where you are going to find the most information.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.